One of the ways to advertise your church is to promise that you're going to preach relevant sermons. And we do want to do that. We want the sermons here to be relevant. The only problem is not everybody agrees on what it means to be relevant. In general, you can agree that relevance has to do with something having significance for your life right now. But you know, sometimes we don't know what really is relevant for our life right now. Sometimes we're not very good in terms of judging what's relevant. That ability to understand what's relevant to you, you know, that's often linked to maturity. So how many times growing up did you ignore what your mom and dad told you because you didn't think it was relevant? Right now, I feel like that's what parenting's all about. Trying to convince my children that what I'm saying is actually relevant. And it's hard. It really is hard. Because we tell them things like, you know what, you want to be considerate to your teacher. You don't just want to get the assignment in. You want to be considerate to them. And that doesn't always seem as important to somebody who's just trying to get it done. So what we're saying may sound like we're telling them to do an extra step. We just happen to know that teachers are human and that a little consideration goes a long way. It's easy for a student to be short-sighted and think, you know what, I just need to get the assignment done so that I can do what I really want to do. If only they could realize that what they really want to do is going to change. And someday, when they grow up, what they really want to do is going to involve money. And money comes from having a job that pays you. And having a job that pays you comes from having listened to someone considerately who is training you or teaching you. So it is actually relevant to learn this very, very important skill. You're going to have to pay attention, and it's going to really benefit you to pay attention with consideration to the person that's instructing you and leading you. But in our immaturity, we often don't see how relevant that is, how relevant it is to learn that, how relevant it is to see that. You know, that's true in the church also. Just like the child who thinks it's only relevant to get to do the least amount of work necessary just to get the thing done so I can do what I want. Well, there are people in the church who feel that way with listening to God. They would never say that. But they just listen for the gist. I just want to figure it out. I just want to learn it. There are pastors who just want to learn enough to get the gist so we can get to the application part. So we can apply this. So we can get to what we really want to do. And the fact of the matter is, sometimes what the Bible teaches that seems the least relevant to us is actually very, very relevant for our lives right now. So take, for example, God's promises about the future. You know, the future's a long way off. Doesn't seem relevant to the present to think about God's promises. But you know, every time the Bible talks about God's promises, it teaches that those promises are relevant for what was happening to the people in the story right then. God's promises are relevant. That's what we're going to see this morning. So you can turn to chapter 47, where we'll be in Genesis. And as we start here, we want to remember what we saw last week. Last week, Jacob blessed Pharaoh, and that fit with what God had said about the patriarchs. He said he would bless those who bless you, and that's what Jacob's doing. He's really applying that. But what is a blessing? Some people read God's blessings, and they look at the grammar, and that's not a bad thing to do. So blessings are stated with imperatives. God says, be fruitful and multiply. And so they would take that as having the force of a command. God's telling you to do something. But prayers also just happen to be stated in commands, or in imperatives. But when we say, give us this day our daily bread, we are not commanding God to give us bread. So imperatives do different things. When God blesses, it's actually an expression of his power. You could call it a performative statement. What he says is what he's performing even as he says it. And so just like his statement in the beginning that said, let there be light, actually performed it and brought light into existence. When God blesses, he's expressing his creative power that's going to accomplish what he's saying. Being fruitful and multiplying is not actually in our power to do. We can't actually be fruitful and multiply. Even if we act in line with what that's getting at, we don't have the power to make sure that we're fruitful and we actually multiply. God has to do that. So even though a blessing is not precisely identical with a promise, it does contain a promise. Notice how Jacob interprets God's blessing. In Genesis 35, 11, God passed on this blessing he mentioned at creation. He tells Jacob there, be fruitful and multiply. Later, and we haven't got to this part, but in chapter 48, Jacob states that very blessing this way. He says, this is what God said, I will make you fruitful and multiply you. What he heard was be fruitful and multiply. What he explains is that God was saying, I will make you fruitful and I will multiply you. And Paul refers to God's blessings on Abraham as promises too. He does that in Galatians 3:16. So even though a blessing is a statement of the Creator's power that he's powerfully working out, a blessing also is by implication a promise, where God is telling us what he is going to do. Now, why would God do that? Why does God tell us what he's going to do before he does it? God's promises, they have greater importance than just telling us what he's going to do. It's not just about information. We're supposed to see how our lives fit with what God's doing. And that's what Genesis 47 is all about. It shows us the relevance of God's promises for our lives. God's promises are relevant for two reasons. They're relevant because of our participation in his promises and because of our perspective from his promises. So we participate in God's promises. That's what we're going to see. And we gain perspective from his promises. And that's what makes them relevant. When we read about his promises, they have to do with our lives right now. So in the last section, I mentioned, all right, Jacob rightly blessed Pharaoh in anticipation of God's blessing. He was really stating, prophetically even, what God is going to do to Pharaoh because he had blessed Jacob and his family. And in this chapter, what we see is God doing it. God blesses Pharaoh in this chapter. But I want you to pay very careful attention to how he does it. He uses Joseph to bring about his promised blessing. So Joseph participated in what God was doing. Joseph participated in God's promise. God uses his people to carry out his promises. Now, some promises that we read about in the Bible then are promises that we participate in. God will use us as his instruments to carry out his promises. That's what we see in chapter 47 here in verses 13 through 26. His promises, they're relevant because of our participation in God's promises. So once again, you hear about the severity here, starting in verse 13. You hear about the severity of the famine, not only in Egypt, but also in the land of promise, in Canaan. That's important so we understand it's good that Israel and his family is there with Joseph. But notice what Joseph does as this famine continues. Verse 14 says, and Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. That term gathered up, it's used with people that are going around and collecting things that they find. And so it's used in Exodus 16 with manna. The people go around, they gather up, they gather this manna that's spread out. But it's also, more importantly, used when it comes to the harvest. It's used for those gleanings, those things that are left over in the land. And so somebody will go in and they would collect all those leftovers. That's what we see here with Joseph. Joseph's gathering up all the silver that's left in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for these rations. And then at the close of verse 14, there's a seemingly random detail. It says, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. The main point is that Joseph had collected all this money. But this chapter is all about Pharaoh. There's no interaction with Pharaoh in the chapter, but it's all about what was happening for Pharaoh's benefit. And so at the very beginning, Moses is clear. What Joseph is doing is not for himself. He's doing this for Pharaoh. He brings this money into Pharaoh's house, not his own house. So at this point, everybody's out of money. Everybody's out of silver to pay for their grain, but they need more grain. So verse 15 says, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone. They're coming to beg, essentially. They don't have money. And they're acknowledging that. But really, realize that they're not actually, at least not ultimately, begging Joseph for food. Joseph is a caretaker. Joseph is overseeing something that's actually under Pharaoh's authority. That's the plan from chapter 41. Joseph said, I'm going to collect this thing under your authority. So he's just caring for it, and he does have liberty to care for his family with it, but he can't just hand it out for free. That's not within his authority to do. And so we see Joseph, as he does this for Pharaoh, he figures out a way to wisely and lawfully allow them to continue to pay for their rations. So he says in verse 16, give your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock. So they give their horses, their sheep, their cows, their donkeys for food, and they do that for that whole year, it says. But the famine's not over after that year. And so they come back to Joseph the following year, and they say in verse 18, we will not hide from my Lord that our money is all spent. The herds of livestock are my Lord's. There's nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our land. What's interesting is the way that they said the word bodies. It's not the normal word for bodies. It's a word that usually is used for either an animal carcass or a human corpse. That's how they're describing themselves. They're wasting away. They're as good as dead. If Joseph doesn't step in, both they, as they go on to say, they will be dead and their land will be desolate. It'll be as without plants as a desert. So the Egyptians this time are the ones to come up with a plan. Joseph last time had the idea about the livestock, but it's the Egyptians that figure out how they can finance these rations now. In verse 19, they say, why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food. And we, with our land, will be servants to Pharaoh and give us seed that we may live and not die and that the land may not be desolate. When it says servants there, just be clear, be better to translate it as slaves as it is in other translations. Now, that's shocking to us. It's a shocking option to modern readers. If we've learned anything in society, it's that slavery is wrong. We have learned that. But we need to understand the situation in the ancient times. So, first of all, ancient slavery was not the racist version that we have experienced in America. That doesn't mean there's nothing wrong with it, but it does say it's much different than the slavery that we know in our history books. We also need to realize that the ancients, they didn't have a lot of options economically. They didn't have banks that they could go to. Couldn't borrow money in that way. It wasn't that accessible. They couldn't claim bankruptcy in order to get out of a debt. The economy in the ancient world was much simpler. So one of the few recourses you had in a desperate situation was to sell yourself as a slave. That's not what we're familiar with, but that was their last recourse. They could make it after losing everything. And under some conditions, being a slave was even better than being free. I mean, you take Joseph's situation before Potiphar's wife lies about him, it's not a bad situation. If he hadn't been lied about, Joseph's experience in Potiphar's house would have been much better than anything he could have eked out in Egypt. It would have been a nice life for him. So it's not all of these things are bad. Even Old Covenant law recognized this as a way to get out of trouble. You could, under Hebrew Old Testament law, sell yourself as a slave. There's one difference, though. The Hebrew doing that would be released in the year of Jubilee. But they acknowledge that. Now, also in Old Testament law, there was a way for you to become a permanent slave. if you thought, this is a master I want to stay under, you could do that. So just recognize slavery in the ancient world isn't always as bad as what it clearly is in our American history. It's all bad in American history. That's not the case in ancient history. So we just need to keep that in mind. We also need to remember that this is not Joseph's idea. This is the Egyptians' idea. They think this is a perfectly reasonable way for them to get the food that they need to. In fact, they actually celebrate what Joseph has done at the end. In verse 25, they say, "You have saved our lives." So they don't feel exploited by this. This is the way their world worked. Now, I'm not saying go and do likewise, obviously, but that is the way things worked. And so we need to understand what's going on in the text from that standpoint. This is what Egyptians do. This is what Pharaoh does. So notice what the text says in verse 20 and 21. It says, "So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was severe on them. The land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other." And look down to verse 23. He says, "Behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh." So Joseph is carrying out Egyptian policy, economic system, the economy, the way that it was. He's doing that not for himself. He's doing this for Pharaoh. And the people respond again in verse 25, "You have saved our lives. May it please my Lord, we will be servants to Pharaoh." So there's no discrimination here. There is an exception. The exception is the priestly families. It mentions in verse 22. And it's not because Joseph is being preferential towards the priestly family. You think, well, Joseph's wife is from the priestly family. So the reason why this wasn't necessary was because of their situation. The priestly families were already getting an allowance from Pharaoh. So they had a consistent flow economically that didn't require them to ever have to sell their livestock, to never have to sell their land or themselves. But other than that situation, all the Egyptians were included in this. Everybody but the priestly families. So the question, though, as you look at this, is what actually changed in their life? After this has happened, what actually changed? They don't go anywhere. They stay on their lands. They stay with their homes. So notice Joseph gives them seed. They're the ones that are planting. And they're working their field. Their status has changed. They're considered Pharaoh's slaves, but they're still doing the same thing that they did before that. Their harvest is now going to receive a 20% tax, just like it did during those 7 years of abundance. So they're going to farm the land and keep 80% of the profit for the next planting and for their food. And what it basically amounts to is a mortgage, only they're not paying it off. But they have an obligation that's settled by that 20% tax. So realize this also about what Joseph has done. He's very generous in what he's suggested here. One, he's done a percentage. He hasn't given them a flat rate. You have to give this amount every year. He says it's a percentage of whatever they do. If they have a bad year, then what they give is lower. That's a good thing. That's a generous thing. But also understand, in the ancient world, other people did this. And historically, we've seen records of a 40% tax or even a 60% tax. So Joseph's tax is actually very reasonable. He's being very generous in how he's approached this. Again, that's probably why they're so happy with what Joseph has done. He's been very gracious in the way that he did it. Now, think about what God has done. God made this promise to bless those who bless the patriarchs. Jacob really prophetically announces that's what God's going to do by his blessing when he blesses Pharaoh. But Joseph is the one who participates in God keeping his promise. Joseph is the means that God uses to carry out what he says he's going to do. So sometimes you can feel disconnected from these promises that God's going to do. It's as though we think, you know what? When God makes a promise, he's just going to do it. He's going to intervene. He's going to carry it out. And the reality is God carries out many of his promises through his people. We participate them in. Now certainly there are some promises that we don't participate in, that God just accomplishes without us. But often he uses us as instruments. He uses us, just ordinary us. Nothing dramatic, just his everyday people. The patriarchs are just normal people. We have seen that. They're fallible. They're fallen. They're normal people. And God used them as a conduit of his blessing. And one of his promises to these patriarchs was that all the nations would be blessed in their offspring. And that offspring, Paul points out, is Jesus. So the question is, how are all these different nations going to be blessed? How is that going to happen? Revelation mentions this picture. It mentions a multitude of people that can't be counted. He says there are from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. How does that happen? How does God carry out his blessing? How does he keep his promise there? Through his people. We participate in God's promise, even a promise that he mentions to the patriarchs here. We participate in that. At the very end of the book, The Hobbit, Bilbo Baggins, he's the Hobbit, that's the title of the book, and Gandalf the wizard, they're reflecting on this adventure. And Bilbo brings up these prophecies. These prophecies had said that this dragon's going to be vanquished and order's going to be restored. And so he's thinking about that and he says, then the prophecies of the old songs have turned out to be true after a fashion. He's not committed to saying they really have turned out to be true, because he's saying that, well, they kind of turned out to be true. His trouble is that he had a part that he played in their coming true. And so Gandalf, the wizard, responds, well, of course. And why should they not prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself. You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck just for your sole benefit? You are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I am very fond of you, but you are only quite a little fellow in a wide world after all. There's more than Tolkien's story at work than just what Gandalf and Bilbo Baggins were doing and the others that were involved. It's not just them that was active in bringing about that prophecy. He's saying, really talking about providence here and how God brings about the promise there in his story, not just for Bilbo Baggins' sake, so that he, as he was going to this adventure, going through it, that he would be rescued from it and the others. It wasn't just for his sake, it was for others. And Tolkien has this sense that there's some providence at work bringing that about. It's not that it happened simply because of their effort, but they were involved in doing it. They were involved in bringing about. That's how God brings about his promises. Very often, it's the participation of his people that brings it about. That is how God is bringing about the ultimate fulfillment of these patriarchal promises. Now, first and foremost, it's through his son, but then it's by means of those who follow his son. So that means that what we do, our participation matters. We're not the ultimate means behind what God is doing to establish this group of people from all the nations and tribes and languages, but we are the instrumental means by which God does that. He uses us as instruments to carry out these promises. So it's the blessing of the nations that we're talking about. Joseph is a picture of that here. Joseph is the instrumental means of God blessing the nations. He blesses Pharaoh and really Egypt, just as Jacob had promised. So that means that what Joseph does in the story is important. And that means that how Joseph does it is important. It matters how Joseph does what he does. Is he perfect? No. Does he have the vantage point that we have on society, on economy, on economics? No, he doesn't. But he is used through his wisdom, the wisdom that he's, I would say, still receiving from God, but it's wisdom that he's employing. He's being wise in this so that Pharaoh is blessed. He becomes prosperous. So what does that mean for us? If we're a part of what God's doing, it matters not only that we participate, but how we participate. This wisdom that we see displayed in Joseph is the kind of wisdom that we need to be using as we carry out God's promises. So we're part of what God's doing to bless some from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. And how we do that matters. That's why Paul says in Colossians 4 and verses 5 through 6, walk in wisdom toward outsiders. And he goes on, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Realize we're a part of the, of what God is doing. That things that are relevant aren't merely relevant for us and for ourselves only. We don't need to be like self-centered little Bilbo Baggins. Now, there's a couple errors that can happen when we understand this truth that we participate in God's promises. The first is to ignore that truth that we participate. There are people that say, no, we don't participate. God just does it all. So there were people, that's the route of the hyper-Calvinists, like those in William Carey's day. William Carey is one of the individuals God used to renew interest in missions, especially among Baptists. He was a Baptist in England. Now, Carey was a Calvinist, but there were hyper-Calvinists in his day that basically said, you don't do anything. God does everything. You don't do it at all. You don't save the lost, the pagans, the heathen. God's going to do that. And that's just wrong. That is not the way that God works. That is not the way that the New Testament teaches. We are used. The patriarchs were told to be a blessing. We are to be a blessing now. And how do we do that? We do that by spreading the gospel. So we need to make the best use of our time, as Paul says. We need to think carefully and deliberately about how we live our lives with a view to our being a part of that. Now, the second error is in thinking that we have to figure out how to get that accomplished. We have to be the ones to figure out how to get all the different nations and all the different people groups. We have to be the one to accomplish it in our own strength and wisdom. We end up kind of shifting from being the instrumental means of it happening to the ultimate means of it happening. And we start to think that it's our strategies that are going to bring it about. That's not what this wisdom is that we're talking about here. God actually tells us what we're supposed to do. So we pay attention to him. And we listen to him. And the wisdom we employ is about being deliberate with our lives. It's about recognizing that how we live matters. And the fact that we want to share this good news. We want to argue with people, not in a negative way. We want to urge them and persuade them that what we're saying is true. But we can't convert anyone. That's not the power that God's given us. He's given us his powerful gospel. And so we need to be wise in how we share that. But we got to make sure that we are sharing the same gospel that Jesus taught us to teach. It's a gospel that's not easy. It's a gospel that Jesus shared with the lost, and he said they needed to count the cost. So when we have strategies that we think this is what works, we're going to give them the gospel light. We're going to give them the gospel. We don't want them to count the cost because that's hard and they're not going to do it. So we're going to tell them a version of the gospel that gets them to respond. A version that says, hey, man, we're getting people to come down the aisle. We're getting them in the tank. We're dunking people. It works. Therefore, it's no, that's not necessarily what you're doing. If you think you've cornered the market on a strategy that converts the lost, in all likelihood, here's what you're doing. You're filling the church with tares, not wheat. You're filling the church with false converts, because you're giving people what they want to hear. You mean I can just keep living my life and get out of hell? That's not the gospel that Jesus taught us to preach to people. So the way that we approach this is, yes, we want to be very deliberate and careful. We want to think about our lives and how we're living, but it's not in our strategies. So we should be a blessing today by sharing the good news about Jesus that brings blessing. We participate in God's promises. That's why they're relevant. Not just empty theological statements. Not just pie in the sky, later on, irrelevant for our lives. These promises, they're relevant because we participate in them. The second reason God's promises are relevant has to do with the perspective that we gain from them. They're relevant because of our perspective from God's promises. So back In verse 11 in this chapter, it mentioned that Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt. Verse 27 is really just kind of repeating that. It's saying what God had done, and what Joseph had done, only it's doing it from a different perspective. In 27, it's doing it from the perspective of Jacob now and his son. But there's also a shift that happens in verse 27. Can you see it? You see the shift that happens there in verse 27. When you read the name Israel there in verse 27, what are you expecting? You're expecting that to be the patriarch, right? And it is, but it's more. So the verb settled there is singular, as in the patriarch Israel settled in the land of Egypt. But notice the shift in the next sentence. It says, and they gained possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. That's the first time in Genesis where the name Israel is used for the people and not just for the patriarch. So God is beginning to keep his promises that he gave to Israel. This promised blessing. He blessed Jacob. He said, be fruitful and multiply. And now they're seeing it happen. God is making them fruitful. He's multiplying them. Now, when we hear that promise to be fruitful, multiply, and we hear that they were fruitful and they were multiplied, that promise continues through the Old Testament. It comes up later on. It's not just in Genesis. And the prophets use it, especially Isaiah, in ways where it's not just genetic multiplication. So in Isaiah 19, it mentions Egypt speaking the language of Canaan and swearing allegiance to the Lord of hosts. It mentions an altar to the Lord in the midst of Egypt. The Lord promises to make himself known to the Egyptians and promises that they will know him in verse 21 there. Then the Lord promises that the Egyptians are going to worship God with the Assyrians. And it says in verses 24 and 25, in that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing. In other words, all three of them will be a blessing like God promised to Abraham in the midst of the earth. Whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, a designation normally used for Israel, and Israel, my inheritance. Those are not three different types of designations. They're synonymous ways of talking about these people being God's people, and it's not just Israel. And then in Isaiah 56, it mentions the Gentiles converting and being accepted in the temple along with the eunuchs. That was a no-no according to the Old Testament law. Eunuchs could not be in the temple area. And eunuchs along with Gentiles would be there. So it says in verse 8 there in that chapter, the Lord God who gathers the outcasts of Israel declares, I will gather yet others to him besides those already gathered to him, being to Israel. And that's just after the promise where God says, my house shall be called a house of prayer for Israel. No, my house will be called a house of prayer for all peoples. This is Old Testament promises that the Gentiles are going to be grafted in. Now, the mystery was, how was God going to do that? That's why the apostles had such trouble with this. It took 10 some chapters of Acts for them to figure out how God was going to do this. They didn't understand it. How is God going to include the nations as his people? How is he going to include them in the temple? And Jesus is the answer to that. I mentioned this in Galatians 3:29. It says, if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. So inasmuch as we belong to Christ by faith, we are Abraham's offspring. So God is fulfilling this promise slash blessing to be fruitful and multiply that he mentioned to Jacob. He is fulfilling that, and we see it in Acts and Colossians. That's why God uses through Luke The same wording as the blessing in places like Acts 12:24, which says, "But the word of the Lord increased and multiplied." Realize that those are the same Greek words used in the translation of this creation and patriarchal blessing, to be fruitful and multiply. And Paul does the same thing in Colossians 1:6. When he says the gospel had come to them, he says, "As indeed in the whole world it is bearing fruit and increasing," you could say, multiplying. Same wording as in Genesis. So what we see here in Genesis is just the beginning. What we're seeing here with Jacob's people multiplying and being fruitful, that's just the beginning of what God had planned. This is eventually going to lead to today. And maybe you wonder if you've experienced it. So this fruitfulness, have you experienced this, what God is doing to cause this people to be fruitful, multiply? Have you experienced that fruitfulness in your life? You know when that happens? That happens when you hear the good news and you respond to it. The good news is that Jesus is the promised king. He is God the Son. He's the one who's going to judge humanity one day. You know, he's going to be the one to determine who gets to enjoy God's eternal kingdom and who is excluded from that and punished. Jesus is the one who does that. And you know, God gave evidence of that by raising him from the dead. He did that because when he raised Jesus from the dead, the resurrection shows that life doesn't stop at death. There is something beyond death. Jesus came back 3 days after being dead. Not only that, the resurrection demonstrates that Jesus now has the power over death itself. He is the one who's going to judge both the living and the dead. But why didn't Jesus come to die? You know, that's kind of a very important factor in this. Why, if Jesus has that kind of power, why would he come to die? Because we are all sinners who deserve to be excluded. We don't deserve to get into this future kingdom that God has established, what he's planned from the beginning. Truth is, we have not listened to our Creator the way that we were created to. We're supposed to. So Jesus, the end time judge, came before the end. He came to rescue sinners like us by dying and rising again for everyone who recognizes that they have failed their Creator and who want to stop failing that Creator, and who believe that Jesus is the divine King who came to rescue them from their sin, and who show it by treating him as their King, listening to him, recognizing that when Jesus tells me to do something, I'm going to do it. The Bible says that good news produces fruit in people's hearts, and maybe it's doing that this morning. That's our hope and prayer. That even right now, if you had not responded to the gospel the way that Jesus describes it, even now you will acknowledge your failure before God. And you will look to Jesus to forgive you, to make you right with him, and that you will then show it by starting to follow Jesus and listening to what he says. And if you want to know what it looks like to follow Jesus as your King, I would love to talk to you about that. And I am available after the service. I'm available all this week to talk with you about what it means to follow Jesus as your Lord and Savior. And this is how God brings about his blessing, through the good news. So like Jacob does here, we need to keep an eye on what God is doing and what he's going to do. So not only do we need to see that we participate in these promises, we need to have the right perspective from these promises. And that's what Jacob does here in these verses. So verse 28 shows this balance to his life with Joseph. Joseph is 17 years old when he's taken from Jacob, and now he spends 17 of Jacob's last years with his father. So they had 17 years in Canaan, and now they have 17 years in Egypt. So where we get to at this point of verse 28 is farther down the road. Now we're near Joseph, or near Jacob's death. And so what we see actually looks a lot like Genesis chapter 24 with Abraham towards the end of his section. Only in chapter 24, Abraham's worried about a bride for Isaac, and Jacob is worried about his burial arrangements. But both of them, they have this eye on God's blessing, on God's promise. So they're making these decisions based on God's promise. And both of them have this strange ritual that make us feel uncomfortable. If you're reading this well enough, you don't feel comfortable about what's going on. But it's something that demonstrates how solemn this agreement is that they're making. And so it happens both here and in Genesis 24. So Jacob makes this request. He says, "If now I have found favor in your sight." Normally, that's not a father saying it to his son. Normally, that's not a superior saying it to an inferior. And you say, well, Joseph is this really important person in Egypt. But this conversation is between a father and a son, not between somebody who is an immigrant to Egypt and this Egyptian officer. So it doesn't make immediate sense as to why this is the case, but this deference, as John Walton points out, is likely because Joseph's status is changing, even right before our eyes. Jacob is right now making Joseph the leader of his household after he dies. Now, Judah does have this role. He's got this leadership that you see, and that's going to play itself out down the road with his descendants. But right now, what Jacob is doing is he's saying, "You're going to lead this clan." That's why he's talking to him about funeral arrangements. The leader of the clan is the one who would make sure and take care of those for the father. He appeals to Joseph's loyalty to his family. He tells him to promise to deal kindly and truly with him in verse 29. That's just loyal kindness, faithfulness. That's what you should expect in a family. And his request is just to take his body when he dies and bring it back to Canaan, to bury him in that burial plot in Machpelah, and to rest him with his fathers, to join him with Abraham and Isaac's bodies. And he makes Joseph swear. He doesn't just say, "Will you do this?" Yes, he says, "Swear that you'll do it." And he takes an oath. He swears. And by doing that, Joseph is accepting divine retribution if he fails to keep this. He's bringing God into this ceremony. So verse 31 ends with, "Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed." And again, you read that and you think, well, that's a weird thing to tell us. And translations are doing their best to try to make sense of it, but the word translated bowed is usually translated worshiped. And that preposition upon is usually what you use to identify what the person was worshiping. And that's why they don't want to quite translate it that way. But the closest to what this is saying in Hebrew that I've found is the Geneva Bible, which reads, "And Israel worshiped towards the bed's head." Again, you're dealing with an ancient work, ancient culture. And what seems to be the case, John Walton again helps us here with some background. He said that in some cultures, in the Akkadian culture, for example, they would put figurines at the head of the bed to kind of picture, to point to this divine protection. So it seems like, since there's no figurines there, Jacob is still culturally pointing to God, worshiping in the direction of God. He's demonstrating that God is the one who has cared for him, and God is the one who's going to oversee this process that Joseph has just sworn to abide by. So why is it that Jacob wants to be buried in Canaan so much? Why isn't it okay to be buried in Egypt? Because God had promised him back in chapter 46 and verse 2 that he was going to bring him back. And Jacob realizes that it wasn't really him, his body. That promise was that he was going to bring his family back. So what was relevant for his body? Where should he rest in peace? It should be in the promised land. He believes God's promise that he is going to bring his people back. So it was important for him to have his body taken back to that promised land. That's what God's promises should do. They should give us perspective. It's like Jacob, we need to keep God's promises in mind when we are living so that we can have the right perspective, the way that we think about life. So this promise here is of land, right? That's the promise he's looking at. God promised this land. We're going to go back to this land. He's promised me that we're going to go back to this land. That promise in the Old Testament, again, it has this route that it takes. And eventually, that promise of land is identified as a promise of a kingdom. Those are two ideas that overlap. And so in Daniel 7, it mentions that that kingdom is going to come when the Son of Man comes. At that time, it says the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and take possession of it. So how does that get taken up in the New Testament? Well, Jesus speaks of inheriting the kingdom in Matthew 25 and verse 34. You say, well, maybe he's just talking to Israel there. Well, Paul uses the same language in Galatians and 1 Corinthians. In fact, 1 Corinthians 15:50 says this, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. So to this Jewish and Gentile congregation, he says this. He goes on to talk about how the resurrection is going to change believers so that our corruptible bodies are clothed in incorruptibility. Our mortality is clothed in immortality. And it's then that he says that Isaiah 25:8 is going to be fulfilled. And death will have been swallowed up in victory. And that's why Peter tells us that we've been born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance. It's imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you. So this promise to Jacob here is something that's pointing forward to our promise. It gives us perspective. So just as Jacob is looking forward to his inheritance and the inheritance of his family, we should look forward to that as well. So does that direct your decisions? Are the promises of God relevant for your life? You could say yes, but if they're not impacting the way that you think, the way that you direct your life, what you do, then you don't believe that they're relevant. Are you living for temporary health and wealth? Or are you living for the promises of God? These promises, they help us understand what's important now. The promises for the future help us understand what's important right now. That's why Jacob can approach a very normal human activity, preparing for his funeral. That's a very normal activity. But he does it with this promise in mind. It impacts what he did. So, do God's promises give you that perspective? So do you have the right perspective? Have you gained the right perspective on your marriage because of God's promises? Do you have the right perspective on your parenting or on your career based on God's promises? Or are you just following the course of this world? Are you just happy if your kids grow up to have a successful human life? And are you just happy that you can live and have a comfortable life in retirement? God's promises for the future are given because they're relevant now. They show us what God's doing and what we're participating in. They show us how to live deliberately in this world, realizing that we should be a blessing. We should share the good news. It helps us aim our lives in the right direction. So if it just looks like, if your life looks just like the unbelieving family and neighbors and coworkers around you, you're not listening to God's promises. If your life looks no different than theirs, you are not listening to God's promises as he intends you to. They're supposed to make a difference in your life right now. They're supposed to make a difference in the decisions that you make right now. So pay attention to them. You should be participating in God's promises. You should be an instrument that God is carrying, that God is using to carry out this blessing that he's going to spread throughout the whole world. Maybe that's right here in our community, or maybe it's overseas. Either way, you should be a part of it. You should be participating in it. You're not on the bench. You should gain perspective from this that helps you aim your life in the right direction. So don't be like an immature child that misses the relevance of this wisdom. Don't miss out on the relevance of God's promises for your life. Let's pray. Father, we look to you. We know that it is nothing but your grace. It allows us to put this word into practice. So we ask for your grace. We ask for your Spirit to enable us to put these truths into practice. That we would participate. That we would gain the perspective that we need to have. We ask for mercy and grace to do that. And we ask for anyone here that is not responding to your Son as they ought to. We ask that if they think that they're okay, if they think that they're fine, that they would recognize before the end, before they face Jesus, they'd recognize what it means to truly follow him. We need your Spirit to do that. Ask it through him, through your Son. Amen.